This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Jet fuel.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Welcome to Fuel, the new business podcast for new business people talking about new business things. And I'm your host, Keith Smith. Fuel is brought to you in association with The Advertist, the UK's only independent business development platform for creative marketing and digital agencies. You can find The Advertist at www.theadvertist.com or call 0203 356 3717. On another podcast episode recently, we asked whether creative ideas aren't creative unless they have a function. One opinion that we didn't solicit was that of Jeremy Davis, a man whose wit is drier than a Death Valley Merlot.
As new business folk working in the marketing industry, we need to understand targeting, not just in terms of our own prospects, but also the target consumers of the brands and clients we're in conversation with. It's what gives us an edge or an insight into the challenges our prospects might be facing and enables us to assemble the right case studies, thought pieces, or insight to get a foot in the door. Sometimes, though, you come across a product or brand the targeting of which belies analysis that you just can't quite fathom. It seems so niche, so nuanced, that you just can't think of another example targeting a similar group, and it leaves us stumped. Now, I spoke about Waitrose Essential Chicken Kiev the other week, surely one of the most egregious examples in recent years. Dairy Milk Chocolate Philadelphia Cheese is another that springs to mind, along with Goat's Cheese Baby Bell. There are also any number of examples from the craft beer category, but then obscurity and absurdity is part of the point in that market, and any craft beer with a potential target market of more than about 10 people isn't worth the label anyway. One other sector which is rife with this kind of thing is the toy market. Now, this is another which has seen huge disruption in the digital age, not just because of e-commerce and gaming, but also due to the YouTube and eBay-enabled nostalgia boom and the emergence of the adult toy collector. I don't have the figures to hand, but the market for vintage collectibles may even outweigh that for kids now. And certainly, you can charge a lot more to a grown-up spending his or her own money than you can through pester power. Sometimes, though, the industry throws up something you just can't categorise. A good place to look for examples is the good old Argos catalogue. Now, I should point out here that other catalogues are available. Now, like any good retailer, they offer a large array of own brand products as alternatives to the more mainstream brands and big name licenses on offer. And one of the most forlorn of these is the imitation Lego bricks. It was while browsing this section of the catalogue that my targeting computer was well and truly short-circuited when I came across a product whose targeting segment appeared so small as to be in single figures. The toy market has generally avoided major historical disasters. There's no Playmobil Pompeii or a Kinex Krakatoa, but I was surprised to discover that one of these Lego imitated brands had launched, no pun intended, a 1,000 brick model of the Titanic. Now, you'd have thought that with 1,000 pieces to play with, they might have included some deck chairs to rearrange, because we all know how kids love puzzle games, especially as they only had to throw in a very small number of lifeboats. It was heartening to discover, though, in such an occasionally hyperbole-prone market, some conscientious copywriter had included in the catalogue, for technical and, let's face it, historical accuracy, the disclaimer, "does not float." It's this kind of level of attention to detail that consumers within the imitation Lego brick-building maritime history buff consumer segment, both of them, are sure to appreciate.
Trust is about the individual buyer who's going to make that decision. And for that person, this may be the most stressful decision they make. It's more than just, you know, clicking a button on Amazon, which everybody seems to think the B2C is emotional, but B2B, it's your career, it's what your peers think, it's what's going to happen in 2 years' time, it's whether you're staking your reputation really on this decision.
It seems to be the case that when we remove sight and sound, All we have are the plain words on the page, and we're better at spotting incorrect, false, or misleading information. Don't take it from me. That was a quote from none other than Malcolm Gladwell in an interview from 2019 with Joe Rogan. He was making the point that when we remove all the non-essential distractions and focus on the written word, we tend to pay more attention. Now, no one knows this better than my guest this week, Ian Truscott. Ian runs a content marketing company called Apropingo, and he helps refine a company's brand through the power of words, images, and messaging. Ian also walks the talk with his own online content marketing platform, Rockstar CMO, a hybrid marketing insight and think tank for the international marketing community. Again, we talk too long, and I split the show up into two parts, so you can grab a pie and a pint or a vol-au-vent and a Shiraz at halftime and settle in for the back 40 minutes, because Ian has a lot of great advice for any company looking to fine-tune and unify its marketing collateral. So let's go ahead and kick off with Ian Truscott on The Fuel.
Yeah. Oh, good God. No, you can't say that out loud. No. Yeah. Yeah. Because next to my deck, I've just got a little pond and and I was kidding about it being the pool.
But yeah. Nice stuff. Yeah. Don't worry. I've been looking forward to having my next guest on the show since the lockdown started all those months back in April. He had me on his podcast at the start of the new normal, when it was extremely unnormal. And since then, so much water has flowed under the bridge. I also have a pretty unique thing in common with Ian Truscott, because he also has a business that, when you Google its name, produces only one result, which is his company's name. His company is called Apropingo. But most of you will know Ian from the other hat that he wears, which is the lead vocalist on Rockstar CMO, which is the UK's only hybrid marketing crossover media platform. So please welcome on the show Sir Ian of Truscott.
Thank you very much, Keith. I don't think I've ever been introduced like that before.
Well, thanks for putting some time aside anyway. And I know we've been dancing around this for quite some time. So I appreciate you finding some time for us. So quick health check on all your loved ones, all well and happy and thriving.
We've been fortunately unscathed by the virus across our family. So that's great. We're all locked down. I've got a 16-year-old and a 19-year-old daughter. So my 19-year-old is just starting her life as a young woman at university. Is now living with mum and dad again.
Congratulations. Well, it was only a matter of time.
Yeah, but it's a joy. And we're looking at the positive of it, you know, having our family dinners every night. It's been great. Yeah, so it's kind of been good.
Excellent. All right. Well, look, we'll come on to Rockstar CMO, which is what we have in common and how we first started talking to it in a bit. But I just wanted to shine a light for a moment on your other business, Apropingo. That's the right way of pronouncing it, right?
Yeah. You do these things. I mean, I've had that company name for years, because this is the second time that I've done a freelance or started an agency. And right. And I just picked up where I left off, and then everybody is the same. It's like, how do I say this? What the hell is that? But I suppose that makes it vaguely memorable. But yeah,
exactly.
So and it's a riff off a Greek expression, meaning to get close and close to you, which is really what marketing's all about. So I don't know whether that's still on my website, but I used to explain that I was trying to be classy. you could call yourself Purple or Aubergine or Thursday or something, but you know, it's not class.
Well, I think it's a great name, and as I say, I mean, it's very easy to Google. But I mean, am I right in describing it as a B2B sort of product marketing company that kind of leans on storytelling or content marketing? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mainly focused around content marketing, but my, I don't know, what is it, 20-odd year career, as well, longer than that, is in B2B software. You know, right. I've done almost every role at a B2B software vendor, from sales, development. I've been a CTO, I've been a CMO, I've run product marketing. So really, when I initially started working for myself again after my last CMO gig, it was really helping people out, other software companies out, with that kind of insight. So it was really around that product marketing, content marketing, and positioning, understanding where you are in your category, all that good stuff. But you know, recently I've started working, for example, with a travel company, because I think that, you know, the content marketing and the discipline that we have as content marketers, it applies across the board. It's understanding your audience. It's understanding what the best answer is to their question. How do you write that? And so I've started branching out a little bit from my MarTech background that I've known for a billion years.
Okay. So, I mean, what does a typical kind of client look like? I mean, what are your typical clients?
Well, you know what it's like. I've been in operation for just over 18 months, so a typical client hasn't really settled yet. But
right.
One of my early clients was a startup, very cool tech, but really wondering how would they apply this, you know, because you know what it's like with technologists, and we've all been on those websites that list all the features and all the things they can do, but they don't list the problem they solve. So a lot of so the early clients were helping people solve to apply the technology and these great ideas they had to a real world problem. And then how do they express that story, and how do they write, you know, why is it that anybody's going to care about their technology? And I think so that's kind of where I started with this, is helping people out with that. But also I've been knocking around this industry for a long time, so I've helped some larger vendors with various things, influencer marketing. I've hosted events for people, that kind of stuff. So it's a bit of a mix. But from my perspective, a content marketing program from soup to nuts is really where I'm at.
Okay, cool. And I mean, you just referenced it there, but I mean, your background is quite extensive in the world of advertising and marketing. I mean, do you just want to just give us a quick run through just to of how you actually got to this point?
Yeah, well, I mean, I know that we're having this conversation around the latest issue of Rockstar CMO that's going to come out in the next couple of weeks, but I'm not a classically educated marketer. I'm like many people certainly in my industry, where I'm a technologist turned marketer. So
right.
So really my path to marketing, and I'm creative anyway, I was creative at school and stuff like that, which I think has lent me to become a marketer. I'm creative in the way that I address problems. I also think that software development is a creative process. So when I write code, I feel like I'm creating something. So I think those two things are quite aligned. So, but my path really was I don't know where you want me to start. I started in a old school computer room that people now only see on James Bond movies, right? With the spinning tapes and the changing the tapes and all that kind of stuff. So that's where I started my IT career. And that was with the civil service. I worked at Scotland Yard. And then...
Scotland Yard?
Yeah. So I worked at New Scotland Yard in London. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, so I worked on Fingerprint, and then I worked for Special Branch, their computer systems way back. And, you know, we were having a bit of a terrorist problem back in the day here in London. And yeah, so, and I was positively vetted and all those good things. And then I got a commercial role because I was a Unix specialist, AIX right. Unix specialist. And then I started running teams, I then moved to the US for a couple of years. And then I started to get into product development, which then got me into product marketing. I ran pre-sales teams. When you're in pre-sales and you work for a software vendor, you've got two choices. You become a salesperson, I think, or you become a marketer, I think. You go into product marketing. So I went into product marketing. And then from there, I then got a CTO. I then became CTO of a vendor here. But that was more of an evangelist CTO. So it was more of a product marketing role. And then I started working for an organization called SDL. I moved to New York to run their product marketing, their global product marketing team. And then I got onto this content marketing thing. So a guy called Robert Rose, who you probably see me talk about, he writes for us at Rockstar.
Yes.
And he features on my podcast every week. I did a little engagement with him, and he really turned me onto it with his book. I brought him in, and he helped me put together a content marketing practice within that organization that we then run. And then I joined an agency. I mean, is this boring you yet? We're up to about 1982. I'm only kidding. This is relatively recently. So then I was with SDL, and then I left, and I joined an agency where I actually created a content marketing practice within an agency in DC. I moved back with my family. We acquired a European SI. I helped with running looking after our clients in Europe. And then I got this amazing and then I worked for McCann for a year, which was quite an experience.
Right,
Mad Men, yeah, the Mad Men of McCann. I think I'd watched too much. Mad Men, to be honest. I definitely want to go and work for McCann.
Walking around smoking tabs and drinking at 11 in the morning and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. I knew how to drink an old fashioned at lunchtime. So yeah, so I thought I was eminently qualified. I didn't really enjoy the big agency environment, because I'm more entrepreneurial than those large organizations.
Right.
But it gave me a great education. And then I became CMO at Accenture a few years ago, and then I started Apropingo after that. So that's kind of a potted history, really. So.
Well, thanks for doing that. But I mean,
that's the end of the show. Yes.
Well, now Ian's run through his CV. As time's up, but we're fine. So onto Apropingo again. I mean, it's got a very clear positioning statement about creating awareness, revenue, and trust. Obviously, I don't want you to give away any special sauce or anything else like that. But I mean, how do you best explain that, like a dinner party or something?
You think that after that long intro anybody invites me anywhere? So what do you do, Ian? Sit yourself down there.
Strap in.
Where that came from really is I've had an awareness, with these senior roles is you've got to express the C-suite the value of what you're doing, right?
Right.
A lot of people don't really understand the role of marketing, let alone if you're going to talk about product marketing or content marketing. It's some executives see it as a tax. Oh, yeah, we've got to have marketing. It's the people that with the crayons and the unicorns and the rainbows in the corner, you know. So I've always had this awareness that you need to convey your value to the C-suite.
Right.
And this really came about in my last CMO role, where I really defined this down to when I was communicating with our CFO, lovely fella, about what we were going to do. And I wanted to make sure that my three top metrics, were what the C-suite would understand. So then I came up with this concept of ART, awareness, revenue, and trust. Now, it's in the wrong order, right? But depending on who you talk to, because trust creates revenue, awareness creates revenue. And so you could put all of those in a different order, but nobody wants to create tar, right? Or a rat.
Or tarot.
So it just fell naturally that I created my marketing methodology in that organization around art. And so I had these top line metrics, awareness, revenue, and trust. And then I would ladder down from there. Anything that we did had to contribute to those three things. And the more I did it and the more I wrote about it, the more I thought about it, I thought, yeah, this is an excellent methodology that people use. And there's no secret sauce to it. It's just trying to speak in a language the C-suite understands to value you as a marketer. What are you doing for me? I think we've probably discussed this before, but you see the rise of the chief growth officer instead of the rise of the CMO. And that's because some organizations have forgotten what marketing is for. Marketing is about building growth, or as I say, building art, but it doesn't matter either way. They're growth metrics. They're about revenue. They're about what C-suite cares about.
Yep. Okay. And so, I mean, obviously, focusing on the word trust in the B2B world, I mean, trust is a key pillar of all communications. Yeah. And people look to leaders, not necessarily in their own organization, but in the peer-to-peer group for kind of insight and guidance on decisions they're faced with. So, and I was reading on your blog recently, and I highly recommend other listeners sort of do this as well, just mainly because unlike other blogs, it's actually full of really useful information. So I thought it was well worth bookmarking. But I read with regards to the sort of content marketing side, when you have sort of trust, awareness, and revenue follow, they sort of come in sort of in short order behind that. So how do, I mean, in your opinion, how do companies and individuals go about creating trust? I mean, what's the key to that?
I think we're seeing this especially right now with the crisis yes. that we've just gone through. And all marketers are now talking about the same thing, which is having empathy for the buyer.
Right.
Thinking about what they need. How can you solve their problem? How can you be the best answer to their question? If you can start to generate, that's why I like content marketing. Because I think if you think about it that way, if you think about trying to be the best helpful resource for your audience. Now, I don't go too hippie about this because all the content has to deliver as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'm not going to create content just to educate the market. I'm going to create content that's going to generate revenue somewhere down the line. It has to be connected. But nonetheless, I think if we take a more generous view about the way we produce content and that we want to help somebody and we create content they find useful, it generates trust.
Right.
If all you talk about is yourself, I mean, it's like if you were in the pub, right? If all you did was talk about yourself and you talked about the numbers you need to make or the thing you need to do, nobody cares about that. Nobody's going to trust you. Nobody's going to ask your advice. So right. I think it's like that. And that's I think, the narrative. And I think we're seeing that especially right now.
Okay. Well, and I mean, this, I think, I mean, especially given the climate when everybody likes to talk about, being empathetic or, there's a lot of talk of companies, having to listen to other people. And really, I think, what I wanted to show was that, with your processes and stuff like that, that there's actually a kind of a lot of thought goes in behind. So it's not just a question of pretending to listen, that there's actually some definition behind it. And I wanted to go through the kind of five main pillars that you've got, which you call the sort of five R's. I mean, I guess probably list them out first of all, and then we'll touch on each one. So the first one is real experience. Then you have research. Then you have reward. Then you have relatable, being relatable, and then reason. So with real experience, I mean, is this best defined as kind of sort of basically showing that you've been there too, that you've done it, you understand what they're doing. Is that what you mean by having real experience?
Absolutely. And it's a joy and a curse having having a blog that somebody actually reads. Thank you very much. And now I got to remember. No, I'm kidding. From a real experience perspective, in a way it is empathy, but it's also, it's really demonstrating that you can help and how can you help? And that's why I'm a big advocate of properly done case studies. And that's why I'm an advocate of the real customer voice coming through the marketing and for you to explain exactly how you help people, not from a features and functions perspective, but actually what did this deliver? And because, trust is about the individual buyer who's going to make that decision. And for that person, this may be the most stressful decision they make. It's more than just, clicking a button on Amazon, which everybody seems to think the B2C is emotional, but B2B, it's your career, it's what your peers think, it's what's going to happen in 2 years' time. It's whether you're staking your reputation really on this decision, which is why the old, nobody got fired for buying IBM.
I was just going to quote that as well.
Yeah. Well, you and I have been around the block a couple of times, right? So, and I went when I worked in supply chain, we went through that with SAP. You're probably seeing that now in web content management with people like Adobe and Sitecore. You do get people who buy the dominant player simply because they see that as low risk. But that's indicative of the emotion that's involved in the decision. And that's really why I think that real experience is important, because you need to build trust that you've actually helped someone like them, that
right.
person, that buyer, not an organization like them, but that person. And what did you do for them?
Yes. Okay. So research. You talk about the sort of value of companies doing their own sort of research for credibility. But, I mean, where do you advise that the line is drawn between like a confirmation bias and a sort of finding research to match what you're trying to do?
This is great.
And then leading with research and then creating the content. I mean, how do you get that?
We could do a whole episode just on research. I think I had a conversation actually through Rockstar CMO with somebody who threw into the Rockstar CMO swimming pool. We could explain what the hell that is, I suppose, because people aren't going to be familiar with it. But we have this concept of the Rockstar CMO swimming pool, where we throw all the bullshit, snake oil, and or whatever it is from the interview that I'm having. And somebody threw in there self-serving research. And the reason why I mention that is because I think you need to define research with what you just said, right?
Yeah.
Which is absolutely. Research isn't for marketers sitting in a conference room with a whiteboard. Right? That isn't research, right? No. And when you come up with your personas, and when you're deciding who your buyer is, or you're doing any kind of research, you know, you need to validate, it needs to be independent and stuff. What my point really there was, we're going to do this research anyway, so why not publish your research? Why not show how you came to this point of view? I mean, for example, I'm working with a travel organization at the moment. Now, obviously, for them, it's important to them to know what the sentiment is right now with travelers and mm-hmm. whether people want to travel again. Well, they're going to do that research. Well, why not publish that research? Because, yes. you know, that then gives confidence in your audience that you know what you're talking about and that you care about what you're doing and that you're basing it on research and all that stuff. So that's what I meant from a content marketing perspective is publishing research.
So it's almost like in the old days of school exams and stuff when you have to show you're working in the side.
I show
how you got there.
I suppose there's an element of that. And I genuinely hadn't seen it from that point of view. I think that's really interesting is that you are demonstrating to somebody, you've given some thought to this, that it was more than just a whiteboard and a flip chart. It was actually, you know, you did actually think about it.
Sorry, go on, carry on.
I mean, I'm not a researcher, but I've worked with some really gifted researchers and people that look at the data. And today we've got access to so much like social data and and stuff that's around that wasn't around back in the day, as you were saying. And the other thing is, what is going to be the point of self-serving research? You're going to continue to do what you've always done. Yes. And you're going to prove that, well, until your business runs into the ground. If you don't find a new audience or you don't find what's disrupting your industry or the change in the consumer consensus sentiment, then you're dying, right? You're not moving and reacting with time. So I think research is incredibly important, and proper research too. And don't be afraid of what you're going to discover.
Oh, I like that. Okay. So, all right. So relatability, being relatable. I mean, it's often said that you should never use a big word when a diminutive one would suffice. And it
well,
often comes
starts with R in this case.
Well, it came up in conversation recently when because I was talking about Boris Johnson, who's I think his biggest weakness is his relatability, you know, and he's a very unrelatable person to I think 90% of the population, because I mean he'll quote Greek philosophers and poets and literary giants when he's talking about the most mundane of things. So for me, he's actually the epitome of being unrelatable. I mean, how do brands when you're talking to them, how do you teach them to be more relatable?
Well, I think I would also say that in Boris's, poor old Boris's defense, that I think when he's more human and he's, he is different from the rest of us, but that doesn't stop you from having an empathy and be appearing to be empathetic. So the reason why I'm setting it up that way is it doesn't matter what you are or who you are, you can still have an empathy with the audience as long as you present yourself the same way. You don't need to have the same education, same background, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
You can cross these divides. And I think Boris has his moments sometimes where he does that, but let's not get into that political discussion. But what I mean about being relatable is really sort of going back to what I was talking about earlier on, is that it's about being useful and being relevant and being and talking in a tone, and this is especially something we've seen recently, right? Is that if you misjudge how you're addressing a particular crisis, you're unrelatable. You know, people can't see themselves in you, and that's that's the important thing. Is what you're writing is actually relatable to their perspective, which goes back to the for me from a B2B. Consulting perspective is when people just write about themselves. That's unrelatable. The fact that you support, I don't know, Jason 1.70 or some geeky jargon like that, or you're this or you're that thing, that's not relatable. What's my problem right now? What do I need to get done? And how is that going to help with that? Is being relatable to the consumer in that way?
And that includes things like tone of voice, obviously, and
absolutely
the language, the actual language and lack of jargon or whatever that you use.
Absolutely. And I worked, I was a CMO of a German software company, and one of the challenges that we had was a real engineering background that they had and a background in publication and very technical and stuff. And which direction you choose? Do you try and make yourself look American? That would be completely fake. You lean into what you genuinely are, and that makes you relatable to a particular crowd. But when you start doing that, you're making choices about who it is you want to be relatable to. So if you don't understand your audience, you don't understand how to be relatable. You can't be relatable to everybody. So there's a lot around that that I think about as a marketer. Is you can't be all things to everybody, and if you want to be relevant, relatable, any of these R's, is that you understand your audience and you make choices about who you're going to choose.
Well, we're coming on to the last R here, which is reason. And there's a saying in the bourbon business, and I love this because I'm a bourbon fan anyway. But that all bourbon is whiskey, but not all whiskey is bourbon. And in terms of reason, I mean, can you actually have a reason without content, and but no content without reason? I mean, is there ever an idea, a time when you can do that?
This is the challenge, isn't it? Is that some of the best and most creative advertising that's been done would have been done without any data, without a reason.
Sure.
Just somebody did it on a whim. They had a massive budget. They pulled this thing off and it's amazing. We're not in that age anymore, although we need to be careful about that. And you and I have talked about creativity, right, in previous podcast episodes. And so there has to be some kind of trust and flexibility about this whole thing. But what really I mean by reason, and this is another thing that I drive a marketing team by, is you have to ask why. So from my background working with B2B tech vendors, is quite often the marketers are really on a hamster wheel. So new product feature comes out, you write a white paper or you write a data sheet on new feature. You just jog along, need to add something to the website. We need to list another tick in the box on the website about this new feature.
Right.
We need to do a blog post about it. We need to do an event. We need to put a webinar together. Why? What are any of these things going to achieve? And really that kind of relates back to my philosophy about art. Is a lot of the time when I've worked with my teams and they've said, right, we need to do this. Let's have a look at this whole need word, shall we? What's the reason we're doing this? Where is this going to go? Well, because the sales team say they need. Do they? You know, well, they've always
but
had.
But do
it.
They, though?
Have they? You know what I mean? Like, why do we produce a data sheet? Who gives a shit about a data sheet?
Yeah.
Right? Wouldn't it be better if we spent more time on a client story and that we were able to tell the story that's in the data sheet, but as on behalf of the client, from the client's perspective? Do they care now that we now support, I don't know, Oracle 9.0. I'm probably dating myself by saying, I mean, Oracle's probably, version 2020 or something. But anyway, you know what I mean? These things are important, and they're important to have in the technical documentation or whatever. But is it really what we're going to spend our time doing as marketers, or whatever the thing is? It could be an email campaign that somebody thinks is a fantastic idea. But unless you ask why at each point and ask, you know, because this blog post was 5 hours, right? So why didn't really fit in there? So reason is what I went with.
Unless you were Jonathan Ross.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You could get Y in there as well.
I could get W in there. And now you're going to need to insert a segment for your American audience of, who Jonathan Ross is. But yeah, so that's really what I meant by reason.
Oh, he won't mind.
We as marketers, we need to... We need to ask why, and we need a reason for doing things.
So, I mean, is there a way of kind of reverse engineering? I mean, you know, have you ever heard of circumstances where, you know, you can actually reverse engineer the reason? I mean, it's almost like, you know, sort of doing something and then sort of saying, well, the reason I did it, and then inventing the reason that you actually came up with it. I mean,
I guess so. But I think that's possibly what we've all, is it? I haven't really thought about this question. I guess it's possibly what what a lot of marketing has been, hasn't it? And but I think, you know, it really is about what I talked about at the beginning. It really is about awareness, revenue, and trust. And if the thing isn't going to produce that, you can't fake that. If you've got a decent metric system, you know, a decent set of metrics and KPIs yep. that you're putting together in your marketing team. And I don't mean vanity metrics or KPIs for the sake of it or any of that bullshit. What I mean is if we're genuinely laddering up to awareness, revenue, and trust, then that thing's going to get exposed.
Right.
Nobody can, you know, unless it actually delivers on something, nobody can say, well, I ran that email campaign because it's going to raise awareness. Well, let's measure that, shall we? And yes. You know, this. So I that's really what I would say about Riz. I think it's hard to reverse engineer in the context of what I was thinking about there.
Yeah, we're going to leave it there for now. Ian had to take a comfort break, and I need to check my flan and take the dog for a walk. For part two, just click on the link for. Oh, I don't need to tell you all that. This is the end of part one. We'll see you again in part two. Ta-da for now.